The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The topic for this evening is community in relationship to this practice that we do, the mindfulness practice, the meditation practice, Buddhist practice. And, you know, last week I talked about mindfulness of the body. And I think sometimes a body, we talk about a body of people sometimes as a body as well occasionally. And it's going to be nice to kind of see the two close together, that the greater your mindfulness of your body, there's actually a wonderful way then to connect to others, in a sense, through that awareness of your body and have a, and help create community. The less we're connected to our body and to ourselves, you might be in some ways kind of very connected to people, but it's probably not going to be the connection to others and community is probably not going to be so deep. Because the depth of connection has a lot to do with how well we're connected to ourselves. So community has been a very important part of my practice. I practiced regular meditation by myself when I first started. I did it twice a day, morning and evening, for 2 years, my last 2 years in college. And it was great for me. And then I, during that time in college, I went to visit the San Francisco Zen Center. And one of the, I spent some days there at a time. And one of the things that stood out to me when I went there was that all the normal social games that I innocently played, was engaged in trying to get people to like me or make an impression on people or represent myself a certain way and show people how smart I was or something, wasn't received at Zen Center in the way that my friends received it. It's like there was no response to these the games I was playing. And because there was no response, the people I met there, they became mirrors for me. And I saw myself better. I saw what I was doing. Whereas with my friends, we all kind of were doing it together. And, you know, and so, you know, kind of we were lost in what we were doing. But there I got to see what I was doing much more clearly. And I thought, this was great. I think I need some help to see myself better. It's one thing to meditate, but it's another thing to have a community that reflects back to you. And so that's one of the first motivations I had to go live in a Buddhist community, was to get that reflection back from people who could be the mirror for me. So I practiced first alone, and that was great for me. Then I went practicing in a community, and that was great for me. Practiced at the monasteries, Zen monasteries, for a number of years. And in Zen monasteries, everything's done, a lot of the life, the practice is done collectively. It's a kind of communal practice, and so you're supposed to kind of be in harmony with the other people in the community and practice together. And then I went to Southeast Asia to practice in this tradition, the Vipassana tradition, and I showed up at the monastery, told the abbot I was there to do his practice, and what should I do? And the first thing he did was he sent me to a little, little what's called a kuti, a little one-room little hut on stilts out on the edge of the monastery above the swamps. And there was a long kind of planks that went across the swamps or whatever to get to the little hut. And I was supposed to go out there by myself and practice alone all day long, alternate between meditation and walking meditation. And because it was kind of swampy right there, the only place close to where I was staying that I could do walking meditation on was there was a kind of a long kind of cement thing that was a grave for someone. And so I would walk back and forth in this, you know, I guess kind of grave top or something. But the thing that stood out to me, I was practicing alone. And after about 4 years of practice, 5 years, I don't know how long, practicing at Zen Center with people, it was a real surprise to me to find myself practicing this long period of time by myself. And then I saw how much, how helpful it had been to practice at Zen Center to have the communal support for practice. And I realized that I wouldn't have practiced as much as I did in my Zen time without the momentum, the support, maybe the peer pressure even, of other people who were involved as well. And I was really carried by that in a very important way, and very grateful for that carrying because it kept me focused, kept me engaged, kept me involved. But then when I went was alone, that what I realized was, well, now, that was great to have that. I was really grateful for all the support I got. And now it's time to define the motivation to do it alone. You know, day after day, all alone, sitting there alone in a little hut, you know, no people, nothing on the walls. It was nothing, right? And then doing this walking meditation by myself in the swamp with this grave back and forth. And, you know, there was this strange animals that lived around. And the monastery had this big pig that sometimes came close by and walked grunting around. So then it was valuable for me to learn to practice alone. And so then I practiced in Southeast Asia a lot alone in rooms by myself. And it was, for me, it was actually quite wonderful. And so then I applied to go to do the 3-month meditation retreat in Barre, Massachusetts, a place called IMS. And I knew the teachers there a little bit. And so I wrote them a letter beforehand and said, well, I'm used to practicing alone. And that's what I like to do in my room. And can I have a single room? So they gave me a single room. And when I got there, I found out that for the most part, it was really nice to sit with other people. And so then I spent most of the 3 months sitting with people and found tremendously supportive again to feel the cocoon, the nourishment of being around other people who I was practicing with. And so my kind of career in Buddhism has been this oscillation between solitary practice and community practice. And both of them have been valuable for me. But today the topic is community practice, how that, you know, a little how it works and the importance of it. I would probably venture to say that for most people, and I'm certainly one of them, doing an ongoing meditation practice, being seriously involved in Buddhist practice, is a lot easier if you're doing it together with other people. It's easier to be consistent. It's easier to not only be consistent, but it's easier to be consistent or engaged more fully when you're actually doing it. There's a fair number of people who come here who find they actually get more into the meditation here, sitting with a group of people, than when they're sitting and meditating at home. There's something about the group momentum or energy or something that kind of supports it. And then, of course, there's some people who it's the opposite. So don't feel like you're wrong if you're the opposite. Some people find it's better to sit quietly at home. And coming here, it's like so busy and whatever, and so many people to contend with. But being a community can be supportive for some people, less supportive for others. But there's a number of values of being in community. One is we learn from each other, and we learn many ways. We learn by osmosis. We learn by just sitting with other people. You don't have to talk to people to learn from them, how they carry themselves, how they hold themselves, the fact that even watching people meditate sometimes or meditating next to people, there's a kind of a learning that goes on just by watching or sensing or feeling what they're doing and feeling, oh, if they can sit still, I can sit still. This is how it's done. And I would emphasize how tremendously important it is, this kind of silent learning and modeling and examples of people. It was really important for me to see how some people practiced with real intent and kind of engagement when I knew they were having tremendous difficulties. Inner difficulties, psychological difficulties, difficulties in their life, and they kept showing up and be dedicated, working, and that meant so much for me to watch them seem to do it. It meant so much for me to watch some individuals. You could kind of feel, I could feel and sense the raptness, the way that their calm, settledness, and how they were completely engaged and involved. So, and just watching and seeing their face and their body, how they were, I got a sense. Oh, it's possible. This is something that can be done. This is a very different mode of being than if you go to a 49ers game and watch people's faces and how they are in their bodies. You know, you get a different kind of example of something. And we don't often get the kind of examples in our life of someone who's deeply settled and calm and absorbed and engaged in this beautiful way that sometimes can happen in meditation. So to witness that and be close to people who are doing that was very important for me. It was also very important for me to meditate with people, be in a community of people where the people were far from didn't live up to my ideals. And I found, as many people find, that most Buddhist communities don't live up to the ideals. Or all Buddhist communities don't live up to the ideals that people have of what a Buddhist community is supposed to be, what a monastery is supposed to be. I lived in many Buddhist communities, Buddhist monasteries and places, and it's a very common phenomenon for people who come from the outside, looking from the outside, come visit for a day or a few hours, say, wow, these people must be saints. This is great. You know, they must be floating on clouds or something. And then they come and live there. And they say, what's going on here? And it isn't that, you know, Buddhists are specialized in being non-ideal people, but rather that Buddhists are people, first and foremost. And generally the people who tend to go live at a Buddhist center, and maybe people come here as well, I'm not saying all of you, but come because there's a good reason for it. And there's a need. People are suffering, they're suffering for a variety of reasons, they don't quite fit in some ways in society, and their life is not quite working, and so, you know, some people are quite challenged. People come here because sometimes there's tremendous suffering in their lives. And some of it comes because, you know, comes with not being, you know, saints. And so the idea is a community like this is open and welcomes people of all kinds. Every situation, hopefully, we can be very welcoming. But what it means is that there's people you're in community with you wouldn't choose to spend time with ordinarily when it's that opening, that, you know, that open. And so I've had to contend with that. And I'm much better because of it. To spend time with people I normally wouldn't spend time with, of all kinds of stripes and whatever people are like, all kinds of ways. Different cultures, different ethnicities, different temperaments, different psychological conditions, different challenges they've had. And to spend time with these people, just be around them and see what they're doing and kind of get a sense from them. And then there's the people for whom just irritate me. That was a really important teaching for me. And there was a great story of there was a spiritual teacher named Gurdjieff. And there's a story people tell of Gurdjieff. He had a community outside of Paris, and they had a person living in the community who apparently irritated everyone in the community, the so-called difficult person. And so Gurdjieff went away. Went traveling with him, he came back, and while he was gone, that difficult person, so-called difficult person, said he had enough with everyone else. And, you know, he wasn't getting along very well, and so he had enough of these people who weren't treating him well, I guess, or something. And so he left. And when Gurdjieff came back, he said, where's the person? And they explained, well, he left, and they were all kind of, you know. And Gurdjieff said, well, I have to go find him and bring him back. And they said, what? They were so relieved, right? And in fact, he went into Paris, found him, and talked him into coming back. And he thought it was really important for the community to have him there. It was part of the teaching, part of the training to learn how to work with that. And so, for example, when I did a long retreat at IMS, this retreat center we have in Massachusetts, it's a kind of long, quiet, silent retreat. People get quieter and quieter. It's very nice, kind of, except for the person who sat next to me. And I like to describe him as having the lumberjack approach to entering meditation hall late. Every time, late, like a lumberjack. You could hear the stomping of the feet across the hall. And then he'd always show up and sit down next to me, and he'd always be out of breath. And we'd spend the next 5 minutes catching his breath. And, you know, where has he been? What's he been doing? You know, it's a meditation retreat. And so then after a while, he'd settle down a little enough, and then the Velcro jacket would come off. And it's ripping, you know. And, you know, the one that, you know, so this was, my great teacher. So you can imagine I had all kinds of responses and judgments and ideas about that and feelings about that. And it was a great, very important teaching for me to learn how to be equanimous with that, to learn how to not to be reactive to that, to be able to hold that in a peaceful mind. And I think that that was more important for me, and learning something very profound and important about myself and learning a different way of being in the world than it was if the person next to me had completely silent, the ideal Buddhist silent type. So I'm very grateful for that person. He did me a great service. So this willingness to look at what's not ideal, to be in community, we have all kinds of people. You have people who are inspiring, you have people who are far from inspiring, and all of them become our teachers. All of them are people that we learn from. It's a very important thing. And then part of what's important in being in community, if there's all kinds of communities in Buddhism. There's, you know, like a very, could be a very informal community for some people who come here maybe Monday night. Some of you, it's kind of informal. You don't really know people. You're happy to come and be quiet and go home. It can be more formal or closer, intimate community for people who start knowing the community, knowing people, and then participating more. And it becomes, for some people, it becomes a really primary community for them, the way that it is for some people, a church or a synagogue or a mosque might be. That it's their primary kind of home and community for them when they center themselves. So some people, that's the case here at IMC. There's communities that are temporary. There's a community that gets formed when we do a retreat. We do maybe a 7-day retreat, and during that time, there's a sense of community that gets formed. And one of the interesting things about that kind of community is that there's very little talking that happens in those 7 days or 10 days of retreats. And when you sit near someone, meditate near someone, sometimes you get to know that person in ways that feel more intimate and deeper than if you spent 10 days talking to them. And talking to them, you get to know a lot about them conventionally, and they present themselves all kinds of ways. But there's something you learn about people when you spend 7 days sitting next to them silently. You kind of get to know the socks they wear, and that's not that important, but you know, there's subtle things and how they carry themselves, how they hold themselves. Maybe you're there when they're crying and you see how that is. You see them when they're peaceful. You see, you know, when they're having struggles. You get a sense of their breathing. I've sat next to people, especially when I did Zen practice and the eyes were open, and I would become very sensitive to the person next to me. Their breathing. And I felt very close. It's very intimate to feel like you're with someone as they're breathing, breath after breath. And so you feel like you get to know people, and in a certain way that you, and so it's very precious. It's very interesting to know people in this that kind of deep way that you can only do in retreat. So there's a community that gets formed there, that we create, temporary one. And the monasteries have, you know, longer, or Buddhist centers have longer communities. But as we enter a community of any type, formal, informal, casual, more formal, longer, one of the things to learn is what your relationship to community is. What do you think? What's your attitude towards being in community, to be in relationship to other people? And there's so many different ways. There's not a right or wrong way, but there are definitely different ways to be involved in community. So I'll give you an example of two different people who had radically different reactions, relationships, understandings of being in the same community. So I was at the Zen monastery at Tassajara. I'd been living there, I don't know, for a year or so. And then two people arrived to be new students there, to live there for a year or so, at the same time. So, you know, in terms of the experiment, you know, the conditions were the same for the experiment. The only thing different was, the environment was the same, the difference was who they were. And they were there for a while, and after a few months, I had a chance to speak to both of them about their experience there. And one of them said, the man said, this is really hard here. There's so much community, so many people, you're never alone. And you know, I just, you know, it's really hard to be, I feel claustrophobic. And then around the same week or so, I was talking to the woman, and she said, oh, it's so nice here. I'm finally alone. There's no people around to bother me, and you know, it just feels so good, finally. So then I asked them both about the background that brought before they came there. He had spent 20 years living alone in Daly City, in a house in Daly City. She had grown up in her house with a lot of siblings and had immediately, at 18 or so, gotten married and had her own kids, a whole little pack of kids. And then, and so when the kids grew up and I guess got divorced, I don't know what happened, she came to the monastery. And she'd always had the experience of being in intense family communities her whole, you know, a life that she had up to that time. And so for her, coming to the monastery was the opposite. For her, it was like finally, it felt like she could be alone and be herself. The community was the same. I mean, you know, the form, how much contact there was, it was all the same. But how people related to it and saw it was so radically different. So when people come to IMC, like here Monday night, I suspect that, I don't know how many people are here, 7,500 people. I suspect there are 7,500 different ideas of what this community is. Each of you brings your own. And one of the things that happens for many of us, maybe not all of you, but it happens to me, is I could easily get locked into my view, what I see is it. And part of the value of community is to help us to break out of our view as being the only view. And I know that I'm a much better person than because I've had people around me who have shared their views, and I've seen their views are different than mine, and I've expanded my perspective on so many different situations in life in a way that I could not have done by myself. The idea that I could do it all by myself and figure it out, and I'm the one who understands everything, is not as slowly has been kind of whittled away, because I see how helpful it's been to expand my horizons by hearing how other people are and how people see things. So in terms of community, we come with different needs, we come with different perspectives, different orientations. It was very powerful to me to practice in a monastery in Japan, where it took me a few months, but because I was living 24 hours a day. We slept in the same room, we ate together, we took breaks together in the same room. We were always together in this Japanese monastery. The only time I was alone was I jumped over the wall, snuck away one day to buy powdered milk because I was getting protein deficiency. And I needed to get some protein in the diet. But otherwise, I was always together. And so, I was the only Westerner there. And after a while, as I started learning Japanese better, it dawned on me that I was living in a different social world, universe, than the Japanese were. And in a sense, it's a collective culture, Japanese culture. So it may be said this way, they were first and foremost a group with individual members. I saw it first and foremost as we were a bunch of individuals who formed a group. And so for me, the individuality of everyone was the most important. For them, the collective group was the most important, how they saw it. And I didn't think that one was better than the other, or right or wronger than the other, but I saw how different it was. And then when I started raising kids, it was very interesting to watch myself and see how that my kind of more individualistic acculturation was in subtle, or not so subtle, I was kind of passing it on to my son. That's what I knew, that's in some ways what I valued, and I could see that I was conditioning him. And I could see that because of that contrast of having spent time in Japan and seeing there's a different way of doing it. So when people come into any community, they come with their own cultural background, their family background of what it means to be in community. Some of it is cultural, like Japanese collective. Some people see collective. And so what's really important is feeling, how do I join? How to be part of the collective? And how do I belong? It represents one of their great needs when they come in. Other people, that's the last thing they want to do, is to be part of a group. And they're so strong individualist that they're looking for how they can kind of settle into themselves and be alone, or kind of be left alone. I saw this in an interesting way when I lived for 2 years in Hawaii, which has a very wonderful mix of all kinds of different cultures and ethnicities, and I think it's culturally very rich to kind of see the diversity there and be part of it. And I was asked to be on a panel when I was at the university there to talk about how we got involved in our respective religions, different people in the panel. Actually, there were only two of us on the panel. And I was a little bit an oddity, being kind of a Buddhist, being a kind of Westerner converted to Buddhism, so they wanted to hear, how did that work for you? And then they had a Japanese-American woman who grew up in, I think she grew up in Hawaii. I'm not sure, or maybe in California, but she was living in Hawaii. And she had, I think she'd become a Christian minister. And so the question, and she had Buddhist parents, from Japanese background kind of thing. And so, but she grew up in California. And so the question was, how did she come to her religion? So I thought it was a nice talk. Nice. I just went to share myself. But as we talked, the contrast between us was quite dramatic. For her, what brought her into Christianity was the community aspect of it. She felt a part of a community. That was important. And as I talked about what brought me to Buddhism, it was about meditation. You know, that's a private, personal thing. Close your eyes. You know, follow your breath. And so for me, you know, this the community was not the foremost thing, but the more individual. So this is a long way of saying that for each of you, you have an attitude, an understanding, an experience, a relationship to being a community that informs how you enter into any community, but certainly into a Buddhist community. Some of you have had traumatic experiences in community. For many people, and this is kind of where we can be blind, we don't understand, or our horizons and understanding sometimes is not so helpful for others. But like I had this view that Spirit Rock was a very safe place to go. Spirit Rock is a retreat center we have in Marin County. It's so safe that there's no locks on the doors. People sleep, and many people don't even think about the fact that they don't lock their doors there because it just feels so safe. And so you sleep in the room with no lock, and the room, the door that goes into the building where the residential rooms are, there's no lock. It's just, you know, how often do you get a chance to sleep in a room? The building is unlocked. And, you know, it's a safe place. It's all these practitioners and all that. But there was a man who came, an African-American man, who had been almost lynched and living in the South in the 1960s by, you can imagine, by white people. And most of the people on the retreat were white people. And he described in an article he wrote about how you know, the idea that he was in this place with no locks on the door, with all these white people, his conditioning, what happened to him, was so deep that it was difficult for him to be there. And only because he talked about it did any of us have any sense that that's what it meant to be in that community. So people come with trauma, they come with experiences of all kinds, and how does that affect how we are together in community? When I was in Hawaii, you know, the idea of inclusion, exclusion was an interesting one because I was taking classes there, and I was the only Caucasian in some of these classes. And it was very interesting to feel the inclusion-exclusion. You know, I was more used to here where I'm working, and to feel what it's like to be the person who's excluded. And it wasn't simply that I was excluded, but what I found very interesting was it was mostly made up of Japanese Americans in the class, but there were some visiting Chinese students there as well. So I was kind of like, clearly kind of left to be only, when we had little group discussions, or, you know, with the visiting Chinese students. That was where I belonged. Or where I was left or something. So we do things to each other. We have experience. Community is a complicated thing. You know, there's what communities does, what communities do, and I'm sure that there's all kinds of subtle and not so subtle things that go on here. There are things we bring with us when we come into community. There's our needs, our personality, our temperaments. There's many things that go on. So each of us, you know, has all this to contend with and to learn from and to work with. And I would like to suggest in some ways that for the most part, none of this is wrong when you come into a Buddhist community to practice. Because one of the beautiful things about practicing is a way in which we say yes to it all. Not yes because anything, there are things which shouldn't be, but we kind of enter into it and say, let's practice with it, let's open to this, let's be honest about this, let's find out about this, let's work through this together. Let's work through this as an individual by myself. This is the place where hopefully a Buddhist community, Buddhist center, Buddhist practice is a place where we just keep opening to what's happening. We keep finding our freedom with what's happening. We keep finding our maturity with what's happening. We keep finding our compassion with what's happening. So I like to think of a Buddhist community, like IMC, the intention of the community is to be as open and receptive and welcoming to as many people as possible, anybody who wants to come. And we used to have, before we remodeled, we used to have 7 doors here to the outdoors, to the outside. And somehow the number 7 is kind of symbolic in my mind. It means something. And I just love the fact that we had 7 doors to come in and out of. We kept them mostly locked, most of them, but the symbolic idea that, you know, we used to kind of, you know, in some ways, my ideal image of a Buddhist center has no walls, just a roof that people come and sit and they're together. And so it's a place where people can come and find themselves, but to understand that it's not always going to be easy. But the difficult, this is a worthwhile place to work through the things that come up and what's going on. That and this is not a place where I hope the intention is anybody is turned away. And we've had people come here who have been challenging for some of the other people who come here. And we had once, many years ago, when we first came here, a woman who probably, if you use a psychological diagnosis, was probably schizophrenic. And I don't know if she was, but, you know. And she would sit here in the hall and have conversations out loud with people. What do we do? Do we say, you can't come? You know. So we were very careful with her, and we tried to handle her and make her feel comfortable to come, but find a way that she could be here that was also comfortable enough for other people, and not kind of say, you can't be here. It was very easy. Some people were like, this can't be, it's too difficult. And one of the great justifications for having some difficult person to go is that if you don't ask that person to go or stop coming, we're going to lose so many people who are not going to come back. Because it's voluntary to come here, right? And people don't want to come if it's challenging. They're coming here to have a good time. And I think that's, I think it's reasonable if people are stressed to come into a place to, where it's the medicine of relief and some peace, and you don't want to come. If you're stressed out, you don't want to come to a place that's going to be stressful, add to it. That's reasonable. But my hope, my wish, is that a Buddhist community is a place where our intention is to hold everyone and welcome everyone, and then realize that finding a way to hold everyone, open to everyone, to include everyone, is a very profound way in which the practice unfolds and works for us. Just like it was for me with that difficult person who had the lumberjack entrance, the Velcro, the huffing and puffing. It was really important for me. I worked through something. And I've had this over and over again in many ways that I'm a better person because I've learned how to open and meet and be receptive for the people that I'm in community with. So I feel I've been tremendously supported by community. I don't think I could have gone as deeply and matured as much in my Buddhist practice without the support of community. No way I could have. I would have been left, I would have probably not been involved, not continued as much as I did. And community itself has been supportive, and community itself has been a tremendously important place for me to learn about myself, about other people, and to open up and be, I think I'm, I'm very, very grateful for it. And that's true also for me as a teacher in this community. As a teacher, I get the sense that most people, there's all these projections on teachers. And I get to sit on this high platform, so it's easy, maybe. But one of the things about it, I think people don't appreciate, is a teacher is also practicing. And for me, it's a practice to be a teacher, it's a practice to be in community as well. And I'm very grateful to have this community be practicing and growing and maturing in this community as well as we go along. So those are my words about community. I thought I'd leave more time, but we have 5 minutes. If you would like to... I have a different idea. Rather than you bring questions up or something, some people know what I'm going to do. Because of the topic of community... I would like to suggest that for 5 minutes you take the risk or the challenge to turn to someone near you and share with them something you feel comfortable to share about what happened to you as you listen to this talk. Something you feel comfortable to share about what was meaningful for you or challenging for you or something. And that's part to help make community. And you can be very brief, but be nice. You're welcome to leave. No, it's okay. That's as I said, we're open to everyone. That leaving is part of being open. Being open to that too. But I think it'd be nice. We could do more effort here. So maybe for 5 minutes, please, someone near you. It could be two. It could be more than one person. It could be two group. So. That's quite a difference between the silent meditation time. So I think what might be nice, given the fact that we sat for a while, is take 30 seconds to close your eyes and just catch your breath, check in, settle in. Notice what you feel like, what it's happening with you. Breathe. Settle in and see if you can be okay with however you are right now. So thank you for being willing to have those conversations. I think it's helpful and valuable as a community to talk to each other sometimes. And hopefully you exchange names, and you're welcome to keep talking if you'd like. And thank you very much for being here today and being part of this.